Blog Talk Radio.
Fascinating show. I just finished a book, but after having a chance encounter, but nothing's chance, as we know, upbeat listeners know, nothing happens by accident, nothing happens by chance. But as I was riding my bicycle around beautiful Castle Island here in City Point, I ran into a gentleman who was kind of a very funny guy and noticed that I was riding my bicycle with one leg because that's all I have. And approached me and smoking a big old Cuban cigar and quite a character. And the next thing I know, I found out he was an author. And so he gave me a copy of his book, reluctantly, because he has only had two of them left. He's virtually sold out of these, but you can still get them as an e-book on the internet. But I'd like to start, I hope he shows up soon, but I'd like to start with the first paragraph. This guy can really write. This description, I think you'll agree, is pretty dead on and absolutely captivating, which made me read the entire book in probably a day. The season was the title of the book is In the Short Grass. The author's name is Haskell Robinson. And the, here we go. We have Haskell on the line now. Hang on a second. There we go. We'll bring him in. Haskell!
Yes, good morning. How are you?
Great. Good to hear from you. I was a little worried, but you're okay.
Yes, sir.
Haskell?
Yes. Hello.
You're there?
Yes, I am.
All right, great. Well, I was just telling the audience about your book and how fascinating and compelling it was. And I'm ready. I'd like to read the first paragraph. Is that all right with you?
Surely.
All right. The season was changing. Summer was going south, and blustering autumn winds were charging into Boston, my hometown. A near decade of unrest in the neighborhoods was winding down. The, quote, social experiment, end quote, implemented by outside carpetbaggers and liberals had failed miserably, leaving deep wounds to its people and their reputation. Forced integration of public school children without much planning and inside knowledge of inner city values caused a volcanic eruption of emotions that left a disaster in its wake. South Boston, to my east, was almost maligned beyond repair for decades and deemed a racial cauldron of thugs. Education suffered greatly as rebellion took to the forefront. School children were forced to leave the sanctity of safe, familiar environment and dropped in places where cab drivers were afraid to pick up fares. The real fight was not over race, but mandated relocation to places the media had labeled dangerous and uninviting. Judge Garrity of an affluent suburb to the west had instigated the insanity to improve the quality of education in the city. The citywide experiment was a total failure, and education suffered. Wow, that's pretty darn good writing there, Haskell.
Thank you.
Did you ever pen anything before? I mean, did you have a as they say, a proclivity to the pen any time earlier in your life?
Well, I think going through the Catholic school system, we were more fed English rather than math, and it turned out I did a lot of writing in middle school and high school, but I never, you know, penned anything for everyone else to read. This is kind of my first venture down the road.
So obviously, but you liked writing. It shows in your writing here.
Oh yeah, I have a way with words and communicating, you know, even person to person.
Yeah, great. Are you a reader? A big reader?
I don't read. I don't read enough. I don't read other people.
Now that's, to me, there's an amazing gap. Your language is that in my opinion, of any great author. I mean, I don't know any authors who write more powerfully or more descriptive than that, or more forceful. And yet, so where do you think you pick up this language, this ability to?
I just think I was born innate. It just came. I don't know. Maybe it was a gift from God. You never know. But I don't read much of anything. I can't sit still. I think I got too much ADHD going on to read someone else's stuff. Unless it's fast paced, you know.
Amazing. This kind of fits into our conversation the other day about innate abilities, you know, talents. The fact that you came out. One of my favorite expressions these days is, and it came up in our conversation, was we're not driving the bus. And I didn't even prompt that. And out of your mouth came the same exact phrase. You remember that?
Well, certainly that's more of a, you know, the higher power, that, you know, things happen for a reason. And, you know, we shouldn't stress in everyday situations because we don't have the control. We need to have a faith that someone's guiding us and someone's driving the bus, you know, good old-fashioned AA type of stuff, you know, that, you know, try to right my ship when my ship was lifting. If you read on into the book, you know, life had told me the curveballs, and, you know, a lot of pain came with those curveballs. And as in the book, I sort of self-medicated, and that's not a good combination.
Yeah, again, you know, all my life I had been, you know, why don't you tell the audience what you said when you saw me pedaling? You're right, you're a guy that is a man of action. You were sitting on a bench smoking a cigar, and as I came down toward you, you said, do you remember?
I said, Tom, I didn't say, Tom, I didn't know you, I didn't know who you were. I said, hey, pal, where's your leg? You're missing your leg, by the way. And you retorted, oh, my God, I am missing my leg. And I looked up, and it just, you know, falling off about, you know, 10 miles a time. And I thought,
well, and again, you and I believe in the same axiom that there are no accidents, and, you know, mm-hmm. that we met for a reason. And we had a great conversation, and it was a gorgeous day. And, you know, not many people have the nuts to say what you say. And people, you know, people in this country, isn't it amazing that we are a country that loves victims? Can you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of finger points. I think that's like that's like a character defect. It's always easier. I'd like to just say, maybe I'm getting off base here, but people love, you know, the defense mechanism is to make the other guy look better. Look what he's doing. Look what she's doing. You know what I mean? They're not taking their own inventory, and they might be part of the problem. And I did a lot of that. You know, when I was out there, my thinking was I blamed other people. I blamed situations instead of looking in the mirror and say, wow, you know, maybe, you know, all this, you know, medicated I was doing. I mean, my book is a recovery book. I don't know if you disclose that, but it's about a guy that realized that, you know, the guy in the mirror might be, you know, like Michael Jackson song, but this guy, you know, some of it might be me, you know, like we get ourselves into so many situations where we're actively using alcohol and drugs to medicate, and being sober now 5 years, it's boring. I mean, my ship just is on a coast right now. It's unbelievable. You know, there's no drama, there's no this, there's no that. I'm not looking over my shoulder. You know what I mean? So to me, it's just, you know, maybe if you give up that one thing, which I call the one thing is the booze and the drugs, you can have everything. I would have never wrote this book. I mean, I'd be looking for the next hit instead of sitting down writing this book. You know what I mean? I was preoccupied with my medication. Now, as I told you the day I met you, we were looking at the ocean, the weeds and stuff, how beautiful. And you have time to be a human being, you know, and instead of a human chaser, you know.
A human being instead of a human chaser? Is that what you said?
So, yeah, like, you know, you're chasing the high, you know what I mean? when you get rid of drugs and booze, you become your sensories. A nice day. I mean, if you're out there active, and in the throes of addiction, you're not looking at a sunset. You're not looking at the ocean, the cool breeze. I mean, you're just, oblivious to everything around you except for that, that next pick-me-up, that next, dosage or whatever you want to call it,
Well, it's funny that you say, go ahead.
But I hope this book will have some people, maybe accept that, hey, look, maybe I should try a different way to cope. That's all. I mean, it could be instrumental in someone else looking at, why am I always, in these jams and these frays? Well, someone has to rescue me, Why is it always me? I mean, is life that unlucky? But it has a lot to do with the, the things that we put in our system, and the way we acquire them and stuff. You're not a whole person when you're getting high. And might develop into like an everyday situation at the end. It is a disease of progression. And at the end, I was, compulsively chasing drugs and alcohol. So, I mean, that's why I kind of have that message in the forefront of this book. It is a recovery book, and it's kind of entertaining as well. I mean, there's a lot of, crazy things that went on. But, go ahead, Tom. Back to you.
You talk about the inability to see a sunset or enjoy a good day and to just keep going, and the addictions. And I have to comment that, one of my, maybe my path, and I'm certain it is, part of the reason that I was blessed to live, because, I had cancer at the age of 13 and a lethal form of it. Only 5% survived in those days, and today it's about 50% with all of the advances they've made. But that's, I don't want to toss a coin on my life. And so if you can imagine that every time you flip the coin, 95% of the time it was the wrong choice. I mean, so I was gone. So I obviously have an amazing zest and appetite for living, and grabbing it all and enjoying it all. And it just drives me crazy when I see people ignoring the most magnificent parts of it, which is, everybody says that the best things in life are free, and they are. And to see, we live here in South Boston, and it's, I call it an open gym, and you see people out there running. And they've actually, sequestered themselves off. I mean, addictions aren't just drugs and alcohol. I mean, work becomes an addiction, money becomes an addiction, things become an addiction. And when people are focused on those things, exactly what you're saying, I'll tell people, look at the sunset, or look at the, and they turn around and they might take a quick glance and they look at me like I'm nuts, and boom, they're still off on their, particular path that day. So I totally agree with you, and it doesn't just necessarily mean drugs and alcohol. It's all the other crazy things that the society holds as valuable.
You're absolutely right, Tom. It's anything that gets in the way of relationships. There could be too much time at the gym, not enough time with the kids, too much jogging, too much thinking about, I know a guy who's addicted to golf. I mean, his family is in ruins. I mean, she's like a golf widow, and he's got young kids. It's like, he's in therapy for his golf addiction. I mean, come on, will you? I don't think there's anything that's really healthy. I mean, when an addiction causes you to lie, cheat, or steal, or hide things, or it upsets the balance of the family, then maybe it's time to get some moderation, But
exactly. And it's all about values, isn't it?
Yeah.
One of the things that... I couldn't put your book down, and I had to eventually, but I had to see it all the way through. And there aren't many books, I am a big reader, and there aren't many books that will compel me to keep turning the pages till I get to the end, because I did want to know, the final outcome. But it's in many ways, I don't know if you intentionally decided this, but in many ways it's a very depressing book in parts.
It is, yeah. Well, those are life's curveballs, the life's struggles,
Yeah, exactly. Now, I noticed, I'm hearing your tone this morning, and your tone this morning is, we put ourselves in these situations. But when you were writing it, it seemed as though you were certainly starting to shed that light. But I think from my perspective, it seemed to me that when you were writing this, and this had happened to me when I started my autobiography, you're so in the past, you're so in the situation you're writing about, that what came out a lot of times is that you were a victim. And did you feel that when you were writing that?
I was a victim. I think a lot of times I was around bad people, other people who are sick and suffering, you know what I mean? A lot of the problems we have were with other addicts, gamblers, and some of my businesses that have failed were people trying to, you know, extract money from me to cover their gambling addiction, you know, and a lot of it is unfair, but life's not fair, you know. I mean, we know that. We know we are victims. It's how we handle, how we cope. That's what I'm saying. I knew I was being victimized, but I chose not to fight the good fight. I chose to self-medicate and to bring that rage that was inside me, to throw gasoline on the fire and fight it that way. Sometimes you got to, like, what's his name says, you got to know when to hold and when to fold, you know. You know you're being victimized, but you know what? Walk away. You know, find a peaceful alternative. Don't stand and fight that fight, you know, high or, you know, not in the right time.
You just answered it for me, and I want to elaborate on that. Throughout the book, I'm saying to myself, why doesn't this guy just walk? Why doesn't he just let go? Why doesn't he, you know, well, you said it's fold him. Because what you did, you met all these creeps along the way. I mean, you saw, it's amazing. I grew up, I went to school where you grew up. I went to Mission High. And I totally understand Mission Hill. And to me, it was, you know, a lot of days I lived over in Dudley Street, you know, 2 miles away, up over the hill, over Elliott Square. And many days, you know, I got on my bicycle and rode to Mission Church, you know, into Mission Church High School. And so, but to me, it was like a vacation. I left an area where I was the minority to at least, you know, there were a predominance of white people in Mission Hill at that time. And as you mentioned in the book, you know, the hill was predominantly white, yet the projects were predominantly black. But in spite of that, there was crime everywhere. But your experience and my experience, and I don't, you know, again, there may be a million causes, but I think when you start to understand that you're not driving the bus, I was put in a situation where, in spite of all of the crime and everything around me, I was, you know, I never played into it. And yet you seem to over and over again. You told me recently, and this is one of the questions I want to ask, you have a brother who's very successful.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, so his experience, do you feel, was totally different than yours?
I just think he didn't get caught up in a lot of things. He wasn't the adventurer. I think that had all, you know, he was the youngest, only three in the family, small family for that neighborhood. And I just think he just got out and just had the willpower just to resist it. A lot of it is you're having fun when you're in the mix. A lot of it, I mean, I know it's the pain train, but you do have a lot of fun. I mean, you live life on the edge a little bit, and you know, it makes life. You're not having a boring day. You know what I mean? It's like, it's like I think he chose different paths. But I tell you, the problem with me is the ego. You know, that's why I didn't walk away. And when you have ego, the EGO, you're edging God out of your program. You're taking your own will. And, you know what I mean, you're not trying to act like he would act, you know, and this is what we learn in AA. You know, I was driving the bus. We're doing it like, you know, the song, Frank Sinatra's in my national anthem.
My way.
You know, and good old Frankie, that's a great song, but that was my downfall. I did it my way because I thought I was all that. You know what? I'm a big, strong guy. You know what I mean? I can use my words and boom. You know, next thing is something else might be coming at you. You know what I mean? I always thought, that I was the invincible, almighty I am. And that led me deeper and deeper and not having, the courage to walk away and to say, look, this is a losing entity. I'm only going to get further into trouble. But I'm going to still keep fighting.
It was so evident in the book. I mean, it was like...
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, it's just, a psychiatrist, psychologist who had me in therapy, he said, listen, we've got a lot to talk about, you know what I mean? It's just, you know, it's crazy. You go from one situation, but that's the life of a garden variety alcoholic. We just keep stumbling, you know. I did well until my biggest curveball, you read in the book, was my divorce and the young children were held hostage, you know, held away from me. And that was something I couldn't fake it. I mean, that was the dagger, you know, that was the straw that really turned me into, you know, a maniac in the streets. And that's, you know, that was my curveball that really, you know, I did well. I mean, I coasted along, had some fun. But when that big, you know, that midlife crisis, when I was 43 years old, which is probably midlife, I would think. I think that's the whole, the gist of the spurring the insanity, you know. I couldn't handle that.
Go ahead.
I couldn't handle that. That was the big curveball, you know. The other stuff, you know, it was fun and, you know, nothing was at stake. There were no kids. There was no houses. There was just, you know, a decade going through my 20s on the merry-go-round, you know, not overindulging, a high-functioning but still, you know, substance abuser. And then when the business came, I put the plug in the jug and just picked my spots. And then when the divorce came, it was back to old behaviors, old hanging out, you know, I reverted back to what was comfortable. And, you know, it's a disease of progression. So, you know, that's pretty much, you know, how I explain the problems, you know.
Well, yeah, and you...
Persons, places, and things, you know. That's what it comes
to. Well,
and so
would you say that was the bottom? I mean, that's the bottom you had to hit?
Oh, the bottom I had to hit was, as you read on in the book, is the, you know, the jails and the institutions and things like that. That's when you know it's like, wow. You know, when you're out there and you're actively, I mean, you're not on the bottom. You're getting high. You're on a high. You hit bottom is when there's nothing left. There's no one to call. You know, the money's gone. You know, it's like, you know, the money's gone. You got to go.
Well, you know, now that I got to bring this up at this point. You know, again, we're not in control. We're not driving the bus. You mentioned, I mean, and you know what I love about this book and your attitude and everything else. You know, there's a lot of things I've been reading about spirituality. You know, once, you know, I knew I was blessed. I mean, when everybody told me that, you know, I got into the medical field, and every single day doctors would ask, well, you know, why was I limping and. And I would tell them what I had, and they would just look at me and go, no, you didn't. You'd be dead. And so every day I had a reminder how lucky I was to be alive. And so I always went for the gusto in what I believe are very healthy ways. And, you know, again, I thought that I was, you know, I started to believe the same thing, that I was driving the bus and things, you know, and that's the whole thing, is that when that ego takes over, and what you're doing with your book is we're getting away from, you know, if you pick up a spiritual book and you listen, you read something by Wayne Dyer or Deepak, I mean, these guys sound like saints, you know, like, you know, there's this other world of spirituality, and if you do this and if you connect with the big, but yet they don't have the nitty-gritty experience that you're talking about. I mean, you're dealing with, I mean, these guys, for the most part, you know, Deepak Chopra's a doctor, Wayne Dyer's a doctor. I mean, he had a rough beginning as a kid. Who the heck didn't? I mean, most of the, except for these kids that grew up in wealthy families, et cetera. But you're talking about stuff that you're saying, here I am on the streets, and the reason that I'm totally out of control, the reason that my life is a mess is because I took the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right. Right.
And that, but in spite of that, in spite of the fact that you're taking the wheel, still you were being, I mean, talk about, I mean, there's a couple of points in the book, but one of the things I'm trying to get to here, tell a story about being in the convenience store in the lottery.
Oh, that was bizarro. You know, I was a new store on the block, Dorchester. I walked in there, and I was unhappy with the people who were running the store. And I said, I want a $10 ticket. And he handed me a ticket. But I just had a resentment. And I said, no, I want that ticket. And I took another ticket, And the one he had handed me, gave to the guy behind me, was a $1 million winner. And I said, at that time, if someone gave me $1 million, I'd have been overdosed. That would have been too much money for me to handle in an active addiction. So I think, I mean, that was a good, you know, turn of my luck, not getting that kind of money when I'm out there sick and tough and getting high, you know? So
amazing. I mean, you know, again, when I talk about this stuff, people look at me and they roll their eyes because they're so grounded in the physical plane, the material plane, and you get glimpses like that, hey, wait a minute, there is something driving the bus. There's some reason that I didn't get that, right?
Yeah, as I say, the accident in my book when I went through the windshield, no one
exactly.
survived.
Exactly, that was my next question. That was exactly my next question.
No one thought I would survive. I mean, nobody gets propelled 50 feet in the air, bouncing off telephone poles and out of the hospital in a short 3 months and is walking around back to his usual tricks, you know. That was
give a little more detail on that. That is one of the major points of the book, is that you, the ego you, wants to take yourself out. Right, I mean, you're at such a point. You're so depressed. But, you know, you're losing the battle in the divorce. You're losing your confidence with your kids.
I'm losing everything, but I didn't think I had a choice then. I think that was a clinical thing where, like I said in the book, it was like a spell had come over me. I don't think I made a conscious. I didn't have a choice there. It was my body was detoxing from narcotics. There was a lot of turmoil in my life. I think that was like, you know, you got the measles, you know. I think it was, biophysical, biological. It was a clinical depression. There was no, here's $1 million, here's your kids back, here's your wife back, here's your business back. You're all right. You're, you know, a bonus from everything bad. I don't think that would have helped. I don't think anything would have got me out except, you know, go into a coma and come out of the hospital. You know, there was no depression. I didn't even go to counseling after an attempted suicide because I was in such a great, you know, I was in the coma. I was in the bedridden for 2 months in the city hospital. But it was a clinical depression. That one had nothing to do with ego. That was just something that captures you and gets a hold of you. And it's like I wrote in the book, it was like a spell. You know, it's like someone put a voodoo pin in me or something. You know, I couldn't help it. But,
well, I recently. You know, someone very, very close to me also had, you know, one of those incidents happened, and the way that they explained it to me is, you know, something's wrong, but you don't know what because it's totally outside of you.
Yeah, I just knew I had to die. I mean, someone asked me, "Is there anything I can do for you?" And I said, "Just throw dirt over me because I'm going in the hole." You know,
In spite of that, describe the accident. Well, what you did. First of all, your wrist.
I went to a very pristine part of the suburbs. Was a lake off of Route 128 in Waltham, and I'm out in this field, and I'm slicing up my wrists every which way from Sunday, and you know, the blood's still in the jacket, but I'm not dying fast enough. I looked down and I said, "God, I'm wallowing in poison ivy." And I said, "No, here's the thought process. Like, you want to die, but you're worried about getting poison ivy. Well, maybe I really didn't want to die. But anyhow, I hopped in the vehicle, and I made 5 dry runs of about, I don't know, 1,000 feet, and stopped in front of this pole. And then I got back, and I just gassed it. I know it's going about 70. And I hit the pole head on. I cut it in half. And I remember going through the window. I remember walking around. You know, everything was dislocated, hips, shoulders. I remember walking around and being questioned by either some kind of police or a medical examiner. And then I went out. You know, he asked me a few questions. And then I went out and I woke up in the Leahy Clinic, you know, several days. And a couple later, and then I started my recovery, and the clinical depression had gone. I mean, I was fine after like the 3 months in the hospital, bedridden. I came out and I had a real zest for life. I was back at it. You know, whatever the spell had been cast on me was now admonished. And I was great when I came out. I looked great. I lost a lot of weight. You know, I was still about 44 years old. You know, and I got back up on the horse, but again. I didn't do my homework, and I got into another business that was, you know, not like the one I had been in for 17, 18 years. I mean, it was a bad choice, but it was, you know, I was compelled to make money to work, you know, and that's all I knew was how to make money and how to work for myself. I never really had the other skills to go work through, the computer skills and all that stuff. I just knew how to make cash every day and make lots of it, you know. So I got into a business without much research and without giving out too much.
Again, it started all over again, didn't it? But again, you know, I mean, I use the word miracle pretty freely because I believe anything, you know, all these little things that happen, it's a miracle that we wake up every day as far as I'm concerned. You know, a sunset is a miracle, but man, you know, what you did, I mean, you you cut your wrists. I mean, I'm laughing because you're okay here today. You cut your wrist, it's not enough. You worry about the poison, and then you drive up for 5 test runs, and then finally plow through a telephone pole, go through the windshield, and still you're okay.
Yeah, amazing.
I mean, that's. What's your take on it? What's your interpretation of that?
I was definitely, God intervened and said, no, it's not your time. And, he kept me around for my beautiful kids, and they would have been devastated. I couldn't imagine what must have would run through their minds at, like, maybe 7 and then 12 years old, burying their dad, who was very close to them, you know. Maybe they might have had guilt about it because, you know, they were used in the divorce process. And I just figured, how would it affect them? But I had no thought when I was attempting, you know, the self-destruction of how they would feel because it was a clinical thing. There was nothing. If they would, you know, gave me a house with my kids on a hill, I still was going to do it because it was a spell, you know. It was just
right.
Something
exactly. Well, I never understood it till it came really close to me. And to see somebody... crazy. I mean, just there's insane. And when you are that, you know they don't know. They're lost. And I totally I never experienced it, but
well,
I can.
People out there, what you have to do is call an emergency number if anyone even makes a verbal threat of it, and just have them put in a safe place, in some kind of holding area or some kind of a mental hospital. If someone is saying that and they're in that spell where they. You know, nothing's going to stop them. They have to be put away. You have to get them sanctioned or whatever. I don't know what the word is.
That's exactly what I did. And then they were, it was just fabulous what they were able to do. I guess the question that came to me throughout reading the book, now that you have this insight, now that you understand things from a spiritual viewpoint, not just a physical point. What would you have done differently? Say, would you, in all of those businesses, every single one of those businesses, even though you were making a lot of money, it was just tarnished with, you know, these tawdry types of people. I mean, you know, there were always hustlers.
Well,
no matter
what
you would... Go ahead.
Those businesses, being big cash businesses, not so much the first business, but the canteen truck, they tend to attract a lot of, and back in the day it was organized crime, a lot of, fringe guys. Well, you know, when there's that much cash going around, things get seedier. There's no more organized crimes in the canteen truck business. Now the police have a stake in it, especially in Everett up there, and they become the organized criminals, you know. That business was tough. It was a tough racket. When there's a lot of cash at stake, money can be tossed around, and
So the part that I'm reading the book is like, oh my God, with all of the danger involved here, with all of the violence, with all of the things that were happening every day, you were in battle. I mean, you were getting up to a war.
Towards the end, but I enjoyed that. To me, that was the fun part. I mean, the FBI wanted me to come in and flip on them and be protected and testify. But I said, listen, I'm having too much fun with this. These guys think they're going to take the almighty me with the ego out. These little punks from a little town north. I said, are you kidding me? You know, that you don't know. You don't know. You got to take your will back. I mean, give it to someone else to handle. Give it to the higher power. Walk away. Should have walked away. Would have saved so much devastation and courts and, you know, and judges and lawyers and everything. If I had just known better, I said, look, this is not going good. Let's get up and pack it in, you know. That's all. Just say, look. But, I mean, to me, it was like a test map. It was like a game you like, you know. And it was everything I liked. You know, there was violence, there was threats, it was just wide open insanity. And that's, you know, you came to my office because I'm insane. You want to try to act insane around me, the almighty me? I mean, come on. And that was a downfall. I mean, that, you know, plus, you know, I was highly medicated throughout those business years. I mean, the first business I was sober as a judge because I was transporting, you know, cardinal law, you know, heads of business and corporate people. I was dealing, you know, but that business there, I mean, you know, I was like, you know, wired to sound. I mean, I was plugged in the morning. I get up, I was supercharged, ready to go do battle, you know. It was...
Well, that's the answer I was looking for. I said, how does this, because it isn't, your description of, again, you're so immersed in the battle while you're writing it that doesn't become clear. At no point did I hear, whether you, that you would have walked. I mean, but you're saying that right now. You would have walked.
Oh, yeah, in hindsight, because I'm thinking clearly now. And I wouldn't have engaged those threats and stuff. I mean, I don't know. I think, you know, people aren't stupid. Most of the people in that business are wired to sound. And that's an immediate attack point, you know. It's like, okay, we know he's on something. We're aligned with a police force. We can use that to get rid of him and get a valuable thing that I had created. They were after the economic. They wanted the money route that I created. They knew I was getting high. And, you know, it's a legal thing to get high. So they have something on you. In this world, I know the people that, do devious things, they always have something on somebody. The first thing you want to do is try to find a weak point on somebody if you are trying to gain an upper hand. And the weak point on me was, look, he's using narcotics. We're aligned with the Everett police. You know, we want his route, you know. So, I mean, whatever happens, whatever we do, even if I would have got shot that day, they'd have thrown a gun in my hand and said I shot first, you know, and they would have done a toxicology and said, look, this kid's got more narcotics than the pharmacy, you know. I mean, you're
right,
automatically,
exactly.
Here's what I'm saying, if you watch Denzel Washington.
Oh, yeah, I saw
Flight.
The gangster, what was it called? American Gangster.
No, Denzel Washington's called, it was a recovery movie. He was flying a plane while intoxicated, right? Did a perfect job, saved most of the crew, the jet plane crashed. But the fact that he was playing the game under narcotics, he did 8 years in prison in the movie. Just for the fact he did a courageous thing, he got the plane landed, but the fact that he had it in his system, you're automatically wrong when you're getting high in any situation. You know, even if you're dealing with scumbags and irreputable people, if you're high, you're already at a disadvantage all the way around. That's what's so important about giving up that one thing to get everything, you know?
Absolutely.
That's the message in that book. I mean, especially if you don't, you know, if you're not doing things in moderation. You know, a guy has a wine every night, fine and dandy, fantastic. Doesn't change his thinking patterns, doesn't involve his relationships, doesn't hurt anybody. And another thing I'll tell you, hurt people hurt people. So everyone that's coming at you trying to hurt you is hurting themselves.
Exactly. Great point.
So,
you're right. If you're happy, you don't mess with people.
No. If you're ever in a good space and, you know, whatever's getting you through, whatever higher power, you have a little spirituality going on, you're not hurting inside. You're not going to want to hurt somebody. You know what I mean? And hurt people is one of the best things that I've come to realize. And in those situations, I was dealing with a lot of hurt people. I mean, they were losing their houses. Bookies were putting notes on their wives' cars. Joey's got to pay up. Well, guess what? This car's going to the barbecue. So they had to do, you know, they had to do what they had to do because they're, you know, gambling. Mostly it was gambling up there, you know. But, you know, a lot of them were getting high as well. I mean, you know, I just landed another den of inequity, you know, another quick, maybe impulsive, bad choice. But, I mean, my part was just as bad as theirs. I mean, I was, you know, blasted every day
on
our
phone. Wow,
so
I'll tell you, this was a Did you enjoy yourself? We're going to have to close it down now because we're going to be shut off here in a second.
Yeah.
But did you enjoy yourself?
Thanks for the call. And, you know, thanks for promoting Haskell Robertson's In the Short Grass.
In the
awesome.
Short Grass. And how can people get the book?
They can go on online and Google it up, in, or Barnes & Noble or Amazon. It's in all venues. It's out there. If they have that title and that author, Haskell Robertson In the Short Grass, you can get a hold of it. You can get a notebook. It's cheap. It's the cheapest way to go. I mean, if you don't know.
Yeah, right.
Like
notebook or Amazon or Kindle, right?
Kindle, all that good stuff.
Well, congratulations. It's a fantastic read. You tell an amazing story, and I hope we can do this again.
All right, Tom. Thanks for the call.
All right. Thank you, Haskell.
All right.
Just follow the beat, for real, you can feel the excitement in the air. Leave your worries behind and just forget about your cares. Grab a Frank at Fenway and see us all.